Move on to our next speaker, who is Dr. Marta Buffito, who is a physician at Chelsea and Westminster Hospital. She is a director of pharmacokinetic research, and she is very much our go-to woman in London when we need advice on pharmacokinetics. So great pleasure to welcome Marta.
Thank you very much, Jane. Good morning, everybody. So yes, in the next 20 to 30 minutes, I'm going to focus on the role of clinical pharmacology in PrEP research. So if we look at these studies listed in this table that I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with and took place in the pre-tenofovir era, we can say that clinical pharmacology didn't really inform the trials. During the tenofovir era, as you can see, the study that involved the tenofovir administration, we can say that pharmacokinetics didn't really inform the design of the trials, but did help with the interpretation of the trials. For example, we know that if people took the drug, because it's an orally, Truvada is an orally administered drug, so if adherence was optimal, the drugs were protected. So ideally, large randomized clinical trials should contain sparse pharmacokinetic assessment, sparse sampling. And they should be also linked to smaller formal intensive pharmacokinetic studies, because this can help with the understanding of the concentration response relationship and inform about factors affecting dose selection and also help with future trial design. And if you look at the characteristic of the optimal PrEP agents, several of those are actually strictly linked to pharmacology, because the drug must penetrate into target tissues. It must demonstrate long-lasting activity, so being characterized by pharmacological characteristics that allow this, and with convenient dosings, should be characterized by a low potential for drug-drug interactions, drug-food interactions. So following the success of the animal studies published around 2008, tenofovir and emtricitabine in combinations were given to humans into clinical trials, and today they are the only antiretrovirals proven efficacious in prospective randomized PrEP trials. Importantly, these randomized clinical trials require a very large sample size, because in PrEP we don't have the optimal surrogate pharmacodynamic markers that we have in treatment. Therefore, clinical pharmacology plays an important role in explaining the variable drug responses. So let's just talk a little bit more about tenofovir and emtricitabine. So tenofovir is administered as a prodrug, is already monophosphorylated, needs to enter cells, phosphorylated twice, and it is when tenofovir diphosphate is accumulated inside the cells that is able to inhibit, to compete with the endogenous nucleotides to inhibit the formation of the HIV DNA chain. FTC is a nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor that enters cells and is phosphorylated three times inside the cells before forming the active anabolite able to inhibit HIV replication. Importantly, it is the active intracellular drug that we care about, that we need to study, and the tenofovir diphosphate is characterized by a prolonged intracellular half-life. We recently published data on the terminal half-life of tenofovir diphosphate, and we show that it was 164 hours. So tenofovir is given combined with emtricitabine, and emtricitabine triphosphate is characterized also by a prolonged half-life, not as long as tenofovir, but as a terminal half-life for 39 hours. So the combination is clearly a long half-life combination. Now, long half-life are thought to be favorable because they are associated to PK forgiveness. And this is very true, and this is very, very important for PrEP. However, when we think PK forgiveness, we need to think about steady state. So because tenofovir is characterized by a long half-life, tenofovir difosfate, we need to remember that it takes 25 days to achieve steady state. So tenofovir is effective and protective after 25 days. It takes about 7 days to achieve protective concentrations. This is a model that was put together by Peter Anderson, who is the pharmacologist in Colorado, who analyzed all the data from the pharmacological data from IPREX. So models are great. So this model shows that if you take tenofovir once a day for 25 days, you achieve steady state and definitely protective concentrations. But when you take tenofovir once every 3 days or once every 7 days, because steady state is not adequately achieved, the concentrations might not be protective. As I said, models are great, but they do still need to be confirmed by clinical data. And I think this model can be confirmed by the data showed by Strand that Ken very kindly already talked about, so made my job a little bit easier. Strand was a trial that looked at tenofovir protection following observed dose. So it kind of took away the problem of adherence or lack of adherence and showed that if you take tenofovir 2 doses a week, the protection against HIV is only 76%, and obviously increases up to 100%, 99%, if you take it daily. Now, just to add one more point on this, the achievement of steady state is important compared to taking tenofovir every other day. What we do not have is data on missing doses. So what happens if I actually do take tenofovir for a month? I do achieve steady state. I'm taking Truvada. So to achieve emtricitabine steady state, it takes about 6 days, so a little bit less. But because of the tenofovir, I do take it for a month, and then I start missing doses. This is an information that we actually don't have, because we don't know when we achieve steady state, how many doses can we miss to still be protected against HIV. And as I said, it's very different than giving tenofovir not every day from the very beginning. Now, having a look again at the tenofovir-containing studies, the PrEP studies, as said many times before and at this conference, adherence is fundamental. And when the drug is there and the drug levels are measured, the drugs are protective. So Truvada has been shown to be protective. For example, in IPREX, it is interesting that there was an increased relative risk reduction with detectable drug in plasma. And in Capriza, a self-adherence higher than 80% and a local concentration in the cervical vaginal fluid higher than 1,000 nanograms per mil was also shown to be protective. Again, if the drug is taken or applied, it works. Let's not please forget about pharmacodynamics. Now, there are several sources that lead to pharmacodynamic variability. And this is, it is important to remember that this is true and it's different for every different drug. So the pharmacodynamic variability, the sources that lead to pharmacodynamic variability for Truvada may be very different than those that should be taken into consideration when studying a different PrEP agent. So several factors do push towards the right the concentration effect curve, which means that you might need more concentration to have a protective effect of the PrEP agent that you're studying. And some are listed here. They are very general, but virological, immunological factors, drug interactions, drug-food interactions, tissue penetration, cell type, toxicity, etc. And we're going to look at a few examples over the next few minutes. So what are the gaps today? What are the answers we still need to... what are the questions we still need to answer? So I think we need to still understand completely the fundamentals of HIV transmission. What is exactly the site of action of the drug? How long must the drug be at the site of action to be protective? How many drugs do I need to have to give to have 100% protection of HIV? Validation of animal models and ex vivo HIV challenges is required, and it would really help in the interpretation of the results with the new PrEP agents that are becoming available or that are being studied. And clinical proof of concept design is still needed. I apologize, it's slightly in contradiction what Ken just said, but I think that it is important to say it, especially with new PrEP agents becoming available. I think for Truvada, the information is there. So this is a cartoon just to underline the fact that where it is important that the drug accumulates in the target tissue, that are the HIV target tissue, and the drug accumulation in the different compartments firstly can be different between male and female, but also it can be very different between the cervical vaginal tract, the female genital compartment, or the rectal compartment. So every drug needs to be studied in detail, and every drug needs to be understood whether it's an optimal PrEP agent, because it does accumulate everywhere where we need it to be. And again, I'm going to just stress the difficulties around establishing the concentration effect relationship from PrEP agents. I think the data around it are quite poor. How much drug do we need? How often do we need to administer the drug? If we can optimize ex vivo in vitro challenge models, what is the protection that we see in vitro that we can translate to be optimal in humans? How often do I need to give the drug? What is the pharmacokinetic parameter that I can associate to response? And for every agent that we study, these are all the questions that we have to ask, and not always the answers are available. At Chelsea Westminster Hospital, we have conducted the first phase one study looking at the applicability, the feasibility of TMC278, rilpivirine long-acting, the nano-formulated parental rilpivirine. And we applicability as a PrEP agent, obviously. And we administer it intramuscularly as a single dose to 60 women and 6 men. 50% of the 60 women had to report as to self-define themselves of African origin. We followed the ladies for 84 days following single drug administration, and we collected plasma, cervical vaginal fluid, vaginal tissue in the ladies, rectal fluid and rectal tissue in the 6 men, and also cervical vaginal lavage for pharmacodynamic analysis. This graph shows the concentration in plasma that we saw in the 60 women over 84 days following the administration of the 3 different doses studies: 300 milligrams in green, 600 milligrams in orange, and 1200 milligrams in blue. We can say that there is some dose proportionality, but also what it is important is to try to establish a target for protection, because this is data we don't have, that we have to create. So at the moment, what we are doing, we are translating what we know from phase 3 treatment studies with rilpivirine 25 milligrams once a day given orally to HIV-infected individuals. And the lower limit, the lower quartile of the concentrations associated to response was 50 nanograms per mL. So this is what I'm using as a target. So 300 milligrams doesn't seem to be enough if the target is 50 nanograms per mL. 600 milligrams might be enough. In this study, it was just around the target. Please keep in mind that here, steady state might not have been achieved, and the second phase one study is actually occurring at the moment where there is a loading dose before 600. But definitely, the concentrations are above target with 1,200 milligrams. These are the concentrations that we measured in the cervical vaginal fluid with the 3 doses studied. And again, I just draw a line for our 50 nanogram per mL hypothetical target. Firstly, interesting, why do we think TMC27A long-acting is an optimal PrEP agent, not only because we can give injections once a month, but also because the concentrations in the cervical vaginal fluid were higher than 80% than the plasma. So it clearly accumulates in this compartment. And again, if you can see, with 600, we are just above the target. It's a promising dose. And with 1,200, we are very much above target. This graph shows the concentrations we measured in tissue, and you can see that there is accumulation of the drug in the vaginal tissue over time, and the concentrations are higher for the higher dose that we administered intramuscularly. Now, the inclusion criteria, although the inclusion criteria of the study were very strict for what concerns HIV risk and therefore HIV acquisition, a lady tested HIV positive during the study on day 84. Her viral load was 370 on day 56 and higher than 100,000 at the end of the study on day 84. She received the 300 milligrams dose only. And as you can see, this is an N equal 1, but as you can see, the concentrations of rilpivirine that we measured in plasma and in the cervical vaginal fluid were all quite low, were definitely lower than our hypothetical target. So this may suggest that higher rilpivirine concentrations are needed to be protective against HIV. And this is actually in accordance with the results of our pharmacodynamic analysis. So Betsy Harrell's group in New York received our samples, our cervical vaginal lavage samples, and that we collected at three different time points, baseline day 28 and day 26 during the study, from 10 women on 300 and 12 women on 1,200, and investigated the antiviral activity against HIV with the challenge in challenge cells. And you can see that we observed a very strong PK-PD relationship. So basically, higher were the drug concentrations, higher was the HIV inhibition in vitro. And very interestingly, if you look at what happens on day 28 in the women who received 1,200 milligrams, there is almost, in the majority of samples, there is 100% HIV inhibition in vitro, again, suggesting that this dose might be promising, or the exposure associated to this dose. Now, again, so the ideal PrEP agent, if we can administer PrEP parenterally, we would remove the issue associated to adherence or lack of adherence to oral PrEP. There's a lot from a pharmacological point of view that we need to learn, because this is the curve that you would see over a month of therapy, for example, because of the slow release of the nanoformulated drug. So we would need to learn again what is the best pharmacokinetic parameter associated to activity, because we are used, the green curves show what we are used to see with either oral treatment, oral daily treatment, or oral daily PrEP. But if you give the drugs parenterally, the concentrations are high over a much longer period of time. So maybe Cmax, the maximum concentrations, might be the important parameter associated to efficacy versus the trough concentrations, which is usually the concentrations that we use. And then, obviously, it would be very important to establish what the target, again, is. So there's different agents that are being investigated as PrEP because they can be administered parenterally. One is ibalizumab, which is a monoclonal antibody that blocks HIV entry, has been intravenously to HIV-infected individuals, and it shows antiviral activity. And because of the long half-life and persistence systemically, will also be studied as a PrEP agent. And another one, as already mentioned by Ken, is the GSK744 integrase inhibitors that has been nanoformulated and is given parenterally, and it shows prolonged exposures over time. Very interesting data have been presented on the GSK integrase inhibitor. At the PK workshop in Amsterdam this year, they investigated the concentrations in the cervicovaginal tissue and rectal compartment in males. So The concentration, the cervical vaginal tissue to plasma ratio ranged between 16% and 28%, and the rectal tissue to plasma ratio was lower than 8%. Now, these values are not that high. However, there was a clear relationship between plasma exposure and tissue exposure, suggesting that you might be able to go higher with the dose and achieve higher accumulation in the target tissues of HIV. So more studies are happening. However, it looks promising. And also, very importantly, at CROI, there was a study that in macaques that showed that the macaques that were administered the GSK744 agents were protected against HIV versus those who received placebo. So I think that collectively human PK data and animal data show that this might be a promising PrEP agent. Now, to further complicate the picture, we really haven't answered the question whether long-acting PrEP involves the administration of one agent only. So GSK and Janssen are looking at their two long-acting nanoformulated agents together. They have presented data in Kuala Lumpur. The study was done mainly from a treatment point of view, but I think one day we might go back and look at the data if we need it for PrEP, because the two agents, when given together, they didn't show any drug interaction, and they showed to achieve over 4 weeks concentrations well above those needed for treatment. Now, I'm not going to comment on cost of this PrEP combination, because I'm talking about pharmacology, and I might leave cost and implementability to you, the experts in the room. But obviously, it's something that must be taken into consideration. If you really like to think about challenges and opportunities associated to new approaches of this new antiretroviral drug delivery system, we're about to publish the review on the topic, in case you find it as exciting as I do. So in conclusion, small clinical pharmacological studies are important. They do inform about concentration response in PrEP randomized clinical trials. They do help to understand the adherence patterns when this is needed. They do inform about concentrations in anatomic site of HIV acquisition. And they also inform us on how to achieve target concentrations, or even better, they teach us about targets and what are the targets that we need to have. So early planning and completion of clinical pharmacology studies is improving. I think that with the new agents, as always, probably in medicine, definitely in HIV, when you start with the new agent, you learn the lessons from the studies that happened before. So I think that with the new agents, there's a lot of pharmacology now, a lot of pharmacological studies that are planned early, ready to inform the bigger trials. So I think we're going in the right directions with the new PrEP agents. Thank you very much for your attention.
Marta, thank you very much indeed. We've got time perhaps for one question. If you'd like to come and join us up here, and then if we've got time at the end, we might be able to take some more. But let's... questions for Marta. Yes, somebody coming to the microphone. We've only got time for one, so...
Good morning. Vincenzo Puro, Rome, Italy. There is an ongoing use of antiretrovirals in serodiscordant couples, in particular to the HIV-negative women willing to conceive. What's your opinion from the pharmacology point of view? Just around the fertility period aimed at conception.
So you're...
intermittent.
I think it's a great idea. I don't see why not. There is... I think you can use different agents. Obviously, if you are thinking about the long-acting, it would be probably one injections or a couple, but I think we need safety data in pregnancy because of the nanoformulation, et cetera, et cetera. But that is definitely a possibility. I think what I cannot answer is how confident we are about TASP
in that situation, because I think when I ask this question around, because it's something we're all very curious about, is are you actually sure that the woman needs antiretrovirals as PrEP if the partner is stable on therapy with an undetectable viral load? Too many experts for me to express my personal opinion, but I am a strong believer in TASP. So I am not sure if we want to increase a risk around conception by adding an antiretroviral. Having said that, I think it's a very important discussion to have with the woman, because the risk of some antiretrovirals have been shown to be quite limited. We have a lot of women with HIV on antiretrovirals that conceive healthy babies. So I don't have a yes or no answer. I don't know if Jane wants to add anything.
No, I was just thinking more commonly we're seeing the other way around is a woman who's living with HIV with a negative male partner, and certainly we've now got some data coming through about treating men in that situation, but it's clearly more complicated for women.
Yeah.